Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast with me, Jasmine Harrison, and I'm joined by the returning Phil Brining and our very own consultant, Esther Adebayi. Hello to both of you.
Hello.
As you can tell by my voice, I'm excited to have Esther on. This week's session was on audits, so Esther is one of our consultants and a new auditor, or new to the auditing world. So she gave her insights on that and opinions while we had Phil's wealth of experience.
When she could get a word in.
Yeah, exactly. Still something that new guests need to get the hang of, I think, including me, to be honest. It's not even a new guest thing, it's anyone with Phil, I think.
Wait.
No comment there.
No comment.
Shocked him into silence for the first time.
So how do you think it went then?
Go on, Esther.
Sorry, what did you say?
How do you think it went, the podcast?
Oh, it went really well. Yeah, I think it went really good. I was happy to do it. I'm just that I'm a very skittish person. Let me just put it that way. I don't like being put on the spot. But once I get my bearing, I'm fine with it. And I think it went really well.
It didn't come across at all. You know, there was no Wi-Fi issues that were threatened.
The Wi-Fi going up, yes.
Yeah.
what was the best bit of it, do you think? You know, which bit do you think was the most useful discussion, if any of it was useful at all?
I think everything was, because while you were explaining how you would conduct a SAP, for me it felt like a training, I'm going to another training that could help me in my next.
Oh, sorry.
No, I think it was very good, because while you were saying, I was like, oh, okay, I think I forgot that one. Now I have something. Now I have something else to add to it. Now I have to do this, because I'm so new with it. There are so many things that I've not started implementing, like questions that I should ask that I might have skipped. So while you were saying it just brought back the memories of while I was shadowing, like, oh yes, this is important, I need to note this out, like the triangle, how you triad stuff. Now I think I need to learn that, so I might give you a call later to teach me that.
I thought it was, again, I'm hoping, I mean, there was some really good chat as well on there, but particularly I like the questions like sampling. You know, do you look at everything, or do you look at a sample of stuff? If so, how do you select that sample? You know, some really good, I mean, people obviously in big organizations have got these big challenges, they've got tons of stuff to have a look at, and you know, not enough time really to look at it. So you know, again, it's really good to get lots of different people's perspectives. No one right way of doing this.
Yeah.
You know, and it's horses for courses, and you know, big organizations might be different from small organizations, might be different from complex or multinational organizations. So it's good to kind of just get a bit of interaction from the
I think that's as well. That's what was great about having you on, Esther. Like you were saying there, you were taking notes off what Phil was saying of, you know, things that you might have that might have slipped your memory. That encompasses the way I would view an audit. You know, it's so complex, and I think most people are listening in, they wouldn't know where to start. There's a lot to consider. Yeah. And
but the problem we have, right, as an external auditor going in, is that Esther, it's an absolute blizzard. You have to be completely immersed in that organization. Mm-hmm. You switch your emails off, you ignore your phone. If you're thinking about anything other than organization, you're going to miss something.
You're going to miss something.
It's very immersive. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, you would miss something. And I think for me, it's getting in, like you said, being immersed in the whole process, but at the same time trying to meet me being new, trying to remember every single thing I need to discuss. Like today I had a meeting with marketing and they were not processing a lot of marketing email. It was just emails. They had a system in place. After 3 months, if the customer doesn't engage with their emails, it deletes them and it's gone forever. They didn't hold on to anything. It was very simple. And then I was like, oh, I've gotten everything that I need. And then I went back, I was like, oh, I didn't ask about telephone calls. I didn't ask about, and then I'm thinking, oh God, how am I going to go back and say anything more questions? And then the other challenging part is, because they're still not aware of GDPR, asking questions, I automatically know the answer is no, I don't know. No, I don't know. So what do I do with that information? How do I assess
how do you tease
them?
It out?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's tricky. And the other thing is that, again, you're having to think on a strategic level, as well as an absolutely down the weeds operational level. You know, what's the strategy and the policy and the procedures for retention, and what actually happens with emails and with you know, record, other forms of records, paper records, and that. And again, that stretches you, doesn't it? That's why I like auditing, because it stretches you, you know, in multiple ways.
I think I was thinking before this session that this might help people who are considering, you know, data protection officers or people mm-hmm. within that field in an organisation for conducting their own audits. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if it's done that because there's so much to consider. While it's given so much insight, I feel like I've learned a lot myself, to be honest. I think it just reiterates the complexity of an audit, and you know, obviously with practice it, you know, it can be very structured, and you can fit into that structure, but it's a big structure.
It's a huge one, and I think going into it, I think I spoke to Babita about it, I spoke to I think Kane as well, and I think for me it's just understanding that it's a process and you have to gradually start building up your style. But at the same time, you have to be very conscious that your style has to embed every single, like, questions, you know, like how you pick, like, the sampling stuff, it has to embed it. So in as much as you're all trying to form my own system of auditing, there are certain key things that you cannot miss that you have to put in place. And I'm still...
coming from different angles there,
exactly. I am scared to give Phil my audit report because I don't know what he's going to
say. Anyone scared to give Phil anything, don't worry.
I think an immensely valuable exercise, you know. You're pinpointing things that are right, you're pinpointing things that aren't right, you're pinpointing how to improve things as well, which is good. I thought that the question I was hoping would get a lot of answers for, you know, how long does it take for you to get a feel for whether an organization is in a good place or a bad place. I thought that was quite, I was hoping everyone would come back with a couple of days, a couple of weeks, a couple of minutes, a couple of seconds. Didn't get that much feedback on that.
I think it just depends. I think for me, once I read the policy and the moment I was told that it was not implemented, I kind of knew that they were not compliant, but that's where the soft nature comes and say, but they do have. So will I just, I can crucify them based on that. So you're now like, I don't want to be too strict. So
without further ado, I think we should get into the main part of the session. But thank you again for joining us, Esther. We will see you soon, hopefully. I'll bribe you with more cakes.
Well, I haven't even had the one you bribed me with.
Coming. I've got some here. Anyway, enjoy the session, everyone. Thanks for listening.
Oh, thank you.
So this week's episode is on audit specifically. For those of you who are new to the session, before we get stuck into the main conversation, we discuss the news a little bit, what we've been up to in the week and so on. So let's get on with that.
One,
Phil.
No, I was just going to say, thank you. Yeah, how I can't remember what my, I have to get my calendar up. How's your week gone? I was in London, I had to go to London on Tuesday. Funnily, if I did the SAR trading session, more of a workshop actually, in the morning, I rushed off to get the train on Tuesday, went down to London, and then that was good. I was going to go to the show that Dave and Rob were at, but I bailed out on that
because
I got engrossed in thinking about some other stuff, and I sat in a cafe and I nearly missed my train. I sat in a cafe for about 5 hours and just rattled up a load of stuff. So and it's been a busy day. I've been doing a lot of work on a couple of cases. I've been helping Rofi out with a particularly tricky case, which is just, it's not a tricky case. It's looking at policy reviews and document reviews. But I mean, to be fair, the documents are just all over the place. And it's an awful lot of work to go through and to critique them and to summarize those critiques and to give constructive feedback. So I've spent most of yesterday just working through that, which has thrown me a little bit. And then this morning, as I say, I got engrossed in this particular case, and I got a couple of phone calls and I helped Joe out. Joe rang me about something a risk assessment was doing. So it's just one of those weeks. But next week, I'm in Ireland at the PCI European Convention community meeting, which is going to be good in Dublin. So we've got 3 days over there. Going to catch up with Salesforce because they're two doors down from where the convention is. So I'm going to go and see them about some stuff as well. So next week, and then I'm on holiday for a week. So I'm not here next Friday.
Okay, thanks for the
nor
warning.
The Friday after.
Esther, we'll see how you go today.
Anyway, that's my week. What about your weeks?
How's yours gone, Esther? Yeah.
So this week I started auditing. So it's a new area for me. So it's been good. It's been good. I don't have anything bad yet, but I came in slightly panicking. Not like panicking, like, oh, what am I going to do? But it was more like panicking in terms of how do I match up to Phil? And we all know how Phil is. So it was more like, how do I incorporate, because I did shadow him on two occasions. So how do I incorporate his method with mine? And then at the same time, trying to own my auditing style. So
you're gonna be much better than I am at auditing, Esther. I think.
Are you sure? We'll see.
So what have you seen in the news? Do you want to talk about this?
What's your week gone like, Jasmine? What have you seen? What have you been up to?
To be honest, my week's a blur as usual. I feel like I get to the end of the day.
It's that caffeine again.
It is. But just the general stuff, I've been chasing a lot of orders. I've had quite a successful week from that respect. So it's been nice. And I've been helping the support guys out a little bit here and there with a few questions. So this morning I was looking for Vicky to see what the liability is around directors in an organisation under the Data Protection Act and you know, personal liability. So yeah, a few bits here and there, but it's been good. Happy Friday as well, as always.
It is. I'm going to just share my screen with you, right? So this is what I've been perplexed with for most of the morning. So I don't know if you can see that. This is a scenario. I've summarised this 35-page case down into this. Now, you've probably seen this in the news, and it relates to AI Clearview, are they called? Clearview, it is, isn't it? Yeah. And you'll remember that a couple of months ago, the Information Commissioner issued a fine of £7.5 million because what Clearview have been doing is scraping 30 billion images off the internet and basically creating biometric data, a vector of the image, and storing it in a database and making it available to various law enforcement agencies and international governance for trying to match facial recognition captured images with this database to try and helps identify criminal suspects as well as victims. So this is what's been happening, and the ICO took issue with this and issued, I think it was started off at 17.5 million, then reduced it to 7.5 million. Anyway, Clearview challenged this, and it went to the First Information Tribunal, and a judgment came out this week, and basically they found that the Clearview AI was acting not within the jurisdiction of the UK GDPR, which was a real surprise to me. I thought, how could this possibly be outside of the extraterritorial reach of the GDPR? But I don't want to go into the detail of it now because it's really complicated, and you have to get hold of the healing schedule for the GDPR, because slotted in there is this new Article 32B. And 33A, and you have to read that to figure out what on earth's going on. But it was quite surprising. I mean, if you read the scenario, you think, oh yeah, that must be something that's regulated by GDPR. But no, it's not. You know, selling to international governments makes it outside of the scope of the UK GDPR.
Okay.
So that's why I've spent an hour, like you have now, just frowning, banging my head against the wall, thinking, what? How? Why? You know.
Yeah. Is that in relation to the territorial scope or material scope of the GDPR?
It's the territorial scope, and in the UK GDPR, we've inserted this phrase called for relevant processing, and that's what this. I mean, it's worth reading. It's a 35-page judgment. Most of it is kind of a bit of background of the Clearview AI, which is well worth reading as well, because it's quite interesting how it works. When you get to the bottom end of it, like the last 10 paragraphs or something, it summarizes the arguments, the legal arguments, which are well worth reading. You know, yes, it's processing. Yes, they're a controller. They're probably a joint controller. They're probably a processor. It's biometric data. All this is really good stuff when you're reading through the case. And then it comes to this, but they're outside of the jurisdiction of the ICO, so the fine doesn't stand.
Right.
But it's fascinating. Anyway, that's what's fascinated me all morning. So I'm not really prepared well for this, because I've got this in my head. I'm going to switch my sharing off now. But if anyone wants to have a look at that, I will find it anyway, and I'll put it in the thing where the where the judgment is. Like I say, well worth reading. It's well written. It's easy to follow. Apart from where it's quoting the law, and you think, God, is that?
No, thanks for that. And so otherwise, you know, from that in the news, I've seen that the Financial Conduct Authority has fined Equifax $11 million for their role in the cyber breach. I don't know if you've seen that.
Sorry, I was reading Lawrence's miles away there. Reading Lawrence's note there. Equifax. I did see that. Yeah. And that's not the first time they've been fined, is it?
No. There's been a few. I think I made notes of it somewhere, but anyway, they were fined $11 million for a cyber breach. I think it's one of the biggest ever in history. So there was.
But $11 million's not a big fine, is it? If it's the biggest ever cyber breach in history, $11 million. Yeah, Equifax is a big company, isn't it? I don't know what their global annual turnover is.
Sorry, me neither. I just got a little bit sidetracked by something I found, but they were fined by the ICO $500,000 because it was under the old Data Protection Act in 2018. So
I remember that, yeah.
Lucky escape, really.
I remember that.
Yeah, and I've also seen as well that TikTok have appealed their €345 million fine from the Data Protection Commission, the Irish Data Protection Commission, in the CJU's General Court as well. I've not seen too many details around on what basis that appeal is on, but
no, I haven't seen either. But it's interesting. It's right, issuing these fines, and they are obviously well thought through. But you know, when they get challenged again, it's interesting when they stand and when they get knocked over, and fascinating stuff.
I think you might have mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, Phil, I'm not too sure, but I thought it was worth mentioning anyway, that Air Europa, so a Spanish airline, I think it's the third biggest in the country, they've been hit by a credit card system breach. So while there isn't much evidence yet of any negative impacts for data subjects, affected data subjects, people have been advised to cancel the credit cards, and it's concerning, really.
Yeah, a lot of hassle. I noticed something I read in The Guardian, which is again a bit surprising, that since 2006, or however many years that is, since 2006, there's been this massive program of scientific research undertaken in Britain, where 500,000 people have provided blood and saliva and urine and bone tissue and all sorts of bio information for research purposes, and it's all been stored and it's all been genomically sequenced and things like that. But apparently the data flowing into this project has dried up because GP practices haven't got the confidence that they're complying with the GDPR. So this is in The Guardian, this story. It was quite interesting to read, and you think, well, why and how, and the article's saying, well, maybe they haven't got enough time to produce the stuff and send it over to this UK biobank. Or maybe it's a lack of confidence that they're complying with the law. But it's bonkers, isn't it, when people have consented to this, albeit in 2006, so maybe they ought to reconsent X years later. But I mean, this is this sort of thing that the GDPR does not stand in the way of. This is people interacting with it and misinterpreting it and applying it in the wrong way, usually, isn't it, when these kind of stories hit the press.
I know. I suppose that's where the concern is. The reassurance that they are complying despite the measures that the portrayed to have in place. You never know, especially when it comes with such risky information. High risk information.
Yeah, and I tell you, one of the features as well in this court, this judgment from the first year tribunal relating to AI Clearview, is that the judge is actually also saying, we're not entirely sure about the way we're treating this, but in all probability, we're probably right. So that, again, is really reassuring to read as a privacy practitioner. And if they don't know, this first year tribunal court doesn't know what it's doing, then fine. I feel much happier about that.
I get that a lot. So if we get asked questions from our customers, for advice on a certain topic, and it's something that we'd have to go away about and think, that it just provides reassurance that they're not too far off.
Everyone's in the same boat. You don't know if you're complying with the law until you don't know you're not.
Yeah.
Now, just a quick couple on AI. There's been a lot again in AI in the news.
Yeah.
It's you know, I read that Stack Overflow, which if you don't know is like this place where people store code and generate code, it's a massive, massive global thing. They've laid off 28% of their staff because they're kind of downturn in work because people are basically generating code and testing code using AI. So that's been quite a major change.
I saw one this morning about a school, a private school in the UK, hiring a AI principal. So this AI robot will act as a principal next to, or headmaster next to
she's got a name. She's
human
Abigail.
Headmaster.
Abigail Bailey is what the robot is called.
Yeah, bit bizarre. to provide support with decisions around, you know, staff support and students and just everything, you know, that a principal or head teacher. I think I read principal because I don't know why I keep saying that, but what they would have to consider. It's crazy. It is crazy.
And Microsoft have got AI bots, talking to AI bots, so you can send an AI bot. Since from November, you can send Microsoft 365 Copilot, which is a bot, to a meeting with another AI Copilot bot, and they'll chat things through and then summarise the meeting and tell all those people that didn't bother to turn up about it. I mean, whew, bizarre, isn't it?
And law is trying to catch up with this. It's already running schools and meetings and whatnot. We need to get ahead of the game, really. Anyway, it's 1:45, so should we go on to the main discussion for the session?
Yes, I don't know. Did you see anything of any note in the news, Etta? Have you been nose to the grindstone on your audits?
Yes, strictly on my audit. I'm yet to read all the stories that you've mentioned today.
Right. Well, you don't need to read them now, apart from that case. Go and have a look at that.
So audits, what are they? Why are they important? What do they consist of? They're the kinds of things that we'll be talking about. First of all, what is an audit? Is it one? Can you define it into one definition, or could it be various things? I think, you know, the way they're approached, that there are different approaches to them. So how would you explain it to start off with?
Do you want to have a crack at that, Etta?
I just said
we won't put her on
this.
The spot too much.
You don't need to.
Just so you know, my backup plan is on full mode right now. But right.
Turn the Wi-Fi off.
I think for me, the way I define it in my head is the GDPR audit is to assess where you are when it comes to GDPR, your compliance level, how you collect, how you process, how you delete. Like, I take the overview of data privacy and by design and default approach to defining it. So starting from how you collect, or your legal basis to collect and then process, and how do you process? Do you share? Do you have policies in place? Is it documented? Are staff aware? Is there training? All the way to how you delete it, and then what happens afterwards. So that's how, in my head, I define auditing.
I think that's good. I mean, people got different terms for it as well. We use different terms in the business, which I also find quite confusing, actually. But for me, it's about checking compliance. This is with whatever it is. You're auditing, you know, ISO 9001, or you're auditing ISO 27001, or you're auditing that people are sticking to the expenses policy, or you're auditing financial accounts. What you're doing is you're looking at evidence to determine if something meets a set of rules, I think, in broad terms. And in this context, we're looking at a variety of evidence as to whether an organisation can demonstrate, because that's what this is about, isn't it, that it complies with data protection law, you know, the GDPR, the Data Protection Act, the PECA, the FOIA, whatever it is. Now we call them audits, we call them assessments, we call them gap analyses. We call them reviews, we call them
discovery
having a look under the bonnet. That's one that we often use. We'll have a look under the bonnet, kick the tires, you know, see how you're doing, send you on your merry way. But those types of they're all the same, and it's the same process. I think, you know, maybe the level of detail is different. I think a gap analysis to me is the report, it's the result of the analysis. So the audit to me is an analysis of evidence to determine to the extent to which it meets the rules.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that. But in terms of, I think for customers, for them, they have a different view on if it's an audit review. I think for them, if it's called audit, it's more in-depth as opposed to when it's gap analysis. Because when I've had conversations with clients about gap analysis, trying to explain that, it's essentially the same. But they're like, no, we just really want to know, you know, what we have now, is it, are we compliant? And then let's go. I was like, yeah, but I need to question you. I need to, like, you know, we need to have interviews. We need to review your documents. So it will take a while. It's not just, you know, something that you just go in and just walk out from and say, you know, I can easily tell you that now, that if you're compliant or not. But in terms of knowing how the organization functions within the requirements that you have or the requirements of the law, it's a whole different ball game. So I don't think customers understand that, so they just try to label it differently.
Yeah, there's different elements to an audit, isn't there? Yeah. There's what you say you'll do, whether people are doing what they say, what an organization says it will do through its policies and procedures, and that awareness of actually applying the measures that are in place and should be in place, really.
Yeah, and what they should be thinking about.
Yeah. Yeah, and what we're trying to do. So somebody went out for dinner with Dave and a chap on Tuesday night in London, and this guy said, "Well, how long would it take you to determine if somebody is compliant or not?" So how long would it take you, do you think, to determine whether an organisation was compliant or not?
Me?
Well, yeah, just as a general question, general question to everybody. How long is it going to take you?
I think for me, the moment I see the policy and I ask, are you aware of it? And they say, no, I can easily tell if they are compliant, because they might have the necessary policies and measures in place. But if staff are not aware, it doesn't make any sense. Like, you're not completely compliant. So for me, I think I'll just put in levels, like level one, level two.
Let me put this again slightly differently then. So, you know, you're having a conversation with somebody, or you've been asked to go and have a quick, you know, review of data protection compliance. You know, how long is it going to take? How long does it take you to formulate an opinion as to whether or not they're likely to be compliant, or whether they're going to be a basket case, whether they're going to be pretty good?
I think if you ask them, are you compliant, and they say yes, that's when you know they're not.
But there might be, Joe.
They are fully compliant in GDPR. That's a red flag, honestly.
Probably if they use the word, if I'm we're fully compliant, then I'll be like, probably not. But I think it's just, for me, it's the awareness. Like, if I just ask you, or what do you know about GDPR, and they can't answer, I'll just be like, oh, they probably don't know. But at the same time, I also have to put in mind that I might probably be speaking to the wrong person.
Yeah, I think Amy's absolutely spot on down the line. My answer was, I can absolutely definitely get a real good feel across a number of different measures in 20 minutes. I could easily say, you know, you're going to have these issues, or you're going to, you know, because you're just picking on these topics like ROPA, processes, privacy notices, retention, DPAs, you know, and if you're getting back some kind of half-baked answer or something that feels wrong, then you know, you can look at a website and get a good feel, can't you, within 2 minutes?
I think you could look at the privacy policy or the data protection policy, or even just a glance over, you know, the governance framework, just to see, you know, quickly where the gaps are or the level of detail of these documents, and make your decision based on that. But of course,
that's not helpful to our customers, is it? What they need to be able for then is, well, where am I not compliant? How not compliant am I? You know, where's the objective evidence, which I think was what audit is all about? Objective evidence that demonstrates your and backs up your stance. You know, you're not compliant, or, you know, you are compliant because I have found this evidence. You know, objective evidence, not subjective. I'm not thinking this. I have found this stuff. I can cite it. I can go back and find it again. That's what objective evidence is all about. So when I'm writing up my audit reports, what I'm trying to do is say, you know, on row, you know, C24 of your ROPA, it says this, you know, so that you can go back and find it, unless of course it's been resorted in the ROPA and everything's in the wrong place because it hasn't got a unique reference number on it. But, or, you know what I mean, in the section 6.3 of your privacy notice, it says this, you know, that is not compliant behavior. So what we're trying to do in the audit, I think, as you said, Esther, is trying to find out, you know, is something embedded You know, it might be written down in a policy, but is it actually embedded and implemented in the organization? Is it working? Is it mature? Is it new? You know, is it not working? Is there variations on the way people interpret it? So, you know, the thing about a proper, you know, decent audit is it takes time. You know, it takes you got to talk to the governance people, the IT people, the people in who think everything's under control, and then go and test it in the workplace. You know, talk to people who are at the sharp end. You know, are you aware of this? Are you aware of that? What happens if you lose your laptop? You know, when did you last get training? All the rest of it, you know, so that you can verify what you're being told either is pie in the sky or is actually correct.
I think sometimes though, where you had it this week, Esther, didn't you, where the organization didn't really have anything in place, so it was like, well, where do I go from here for this, was it a 3 or 5 day audit?
So they actually did have really good policies, but no one had an idea where to find them.
Not embedded, not implemented.
So they were apparently, I think the IT department were the ones controlling all the data protection policies, DPIA, ROPAs, so nobody had an idea where to find it. So that got me a bit confused. Like, oh, you do have really good policies in place. Your ROPA is up. Well, part of it is up to date. You have, they do have DPIA procedures, SAR procedure. Mm. They had so many things, but they just had no clue. The rest of the, minus the IT, the rest of the organization had no clue. So it was a bit confusing in terms of me saying, are they compliant? Probably not, because the staffs are not aware, but they do have, the IT department might be compliant. So it's like one branch of the organization is compliant and the rest isn't. So it's a bit,
I suppose, I don't know if this would, you know, going on your point, Phil, about making sure that you've got an objective overview of a level of compliance in an organization, but another approach to that, once you're aware that nobody has any idea of these policies, could you then look towards the culture of data protection and how they see data protection, if there's a centralized place for storing things, if they've got these measures in place but just aren't aware of where these measures come from, essentially. I don't know if that would at least help the rating a little bit.
I think that's good. I mean, one of the tricky bits is, as you found out this week, Esther, is that you get a blizzard of information, you know, and you know, if you're in back-to-back interviews in a alien environment, you've not, you know, been to that business before or organized before, you don't entirely know the full extent of the processing activities. You've done your research in advance, and you've read the ROPA, which might or might not be any good, and you've looked at the website and so on and so forth. So you're going and there's an absolute blizzard of information. So structuring it is really important, I think.
Yeah.
And what you've mentioned, Jasmine, is the policy any good? What we tend to do, what I tend to do, I don't know if it's the right way or not, but we tend to break the audit into different topical areas, and the information management system, or the information governance system, or whatever you want to call it, is one of those elements. So rather than looking, I mean, every single element, we're thinking, is there a policy and a procedure? Is there kind of, we're going to go on to this in a minute, and is it embedded? But there's a whole load in between that. So you look at that for processes. You know, is a policy on preserve processes, a procedure appointing and decommissioning processes? Is there evidence of the processes? You know, is there a register of them? Are there contracts? Are those contracts compliant? You're going down this funnel of information. But I tend to take policies and procedures and the management stuff as a overall thing. So your governance framework is strong, or it's weak, or it's not embedded, or it's contradictory, or whatever it is. So I pick on the kind of the policy in each topical area, but then I look at the whole of the governance framework. Is it managed? Is it version controlled? Is somebody responsible for it? You know, is it any good? And, you know, I looked at a policy this week of the work I was doing with Rothian. You know, the SAR procedure was quoting Section 45 of the Data Protection Act as, you know, the subject tax request policies. Well, I know, and you all know, that's in the law enforcement directive. So it's not any relevant at all to this particular type of organisation. And then they were citing Schedule 9 of the Data Protection Act. That's intelligence services processing. Well, I mean, that policy is no good. You know, it's wrong. It's on a 3-year review as well. So when the hell is it going to get put right?
Chris has said in the chat, do you not think, though, that sometimes everyone else in an organisation really doesn't care as long as IT have the policies? I think that's a fair comment. But yeah. I think that's also something that...
if you don't know about them.
I don't think it's about not knowing. I think,
I think it's seen as, you know, say with health and safety sits with people who are responsible for health and safety and nobody else really. For example, first aid, people don't need to know about that. And they think, okay, that's sorted there. They've got that covered. Whereas data protection, it's got to be a culture throughout every person in that organization. Everyone has that responsibility. And that's what some organizations really need to focus on and improve, but some just don't really have or do. This is a long one. I can see your
The policies have to be owned by someone and stored somewhere, but people need to know, not all of it necessarily, but they certainly need to know the bits that are relevant to them. So the policies are important. It's the procedures that are the key thing. Mm-hmm. So if you want to try and regulate how people do go through that process, appointment selection process, or how to do a DPIA, then people need training. This, to me, is the emphasis of training is this is the way to do this here. This is the way to apply this policy here. Mm-hmm. And most of the training, again, we see when we're auditing is, we have this annual or every by 2 years, look at this e-learning thing. There's nothing at all that's tailored to the particular environment, how to do it here.
Yeah, I think as well, that idea of or the concept of process owners is really important in ensuring that data protection, you know, spreads across the whole organization and that people are responsible within their respective areas from the top down to consider and practice data protection in everything that they do.
Yeah, I think this is what Lawrence is saying, you know, it's kind of need to know basis. People need to know that piece of the procedure or the policy. Make sure they know it. If you don't, then don't burden them with it, because they're going to get fed up with it.
I think that's what I got during the audit. Like, people generally, because of when GDPR came out and we was in the news, people are aware of data protection. They know the bare minimum they need to know, and that's it, and they're fine with it. Now, the burden is then for them. What I could sense from the audit is that the burden is on the organization to secure the data, not them. They don't see themselves as people who need to protect personnel. And that's what, when I'm doing training, that's what I emphasize, that it's up to you. So I always have to give example. I always use the doctors as example. Like, imagine if your doctor has the same view as you and then they leave your personal data lying around. Would you like it? Like, no other. Exactly. So think about it that same way. It's also your responsibility.
Yeah. People see data protection as a piece of legislation and, you know, they're not lawyers or they don't do law.
Exactly.
Or don't need to know about
it. It's not
it.
Their responsibility.
Whereas it's real life, isn't it?
So I wanted to try and get, you know, get into the how. I don't know if this is no relevance and everyone tell us to shut up on the chat, but I wanted to try and get into the how about auditing. You know, how do you actually do it? You know, it's easy to say, well, we're looking for objective evidence, but what are we actually looking for? And then I wanted to talk through some of the challenges, you know, the ratings, how you're rating things, how you're going to get some kind of assessment criteria in place, you know, and then action plans and reporting back. You know, there's a whole host of stuff to talk about in auditing, but the kind of the how-to bit, you know, Esther, you've kind of the last few weeks been, or months really, been, you know, thinking about stuff, looking at stuff, building templates, building checklists, looking. I think it's very useful, the old ICO's audit handbook from 2001, which I'm happy to share. I don't think it's available in many places online anymore, but it's a brilliant document because it's got audit checklists. It's all based on the 98 Act, but you can pull a lot of things out of it still. You know, it's the how you're doing it. So give us your perspective, Esther, on, you know, how you're going about conducting. Let's just pick one topic, like privacy notices or ROPAs or processes, because I think it's the same process for whatever topical area you're looking at.
So first of all, Phil, you know, I'm still getting the hang of it, so my process might not be.
You can throw it back at any time, but.
For me, starting, first of all, when I review let's say it's ROPA, for instance, when I review it and I check, you know, the headings, if they have the necessary headings in place, if all their departments that process personal data have been captured in the ROPA, and then it's easy for me to know who I'm going to interview and the questions that I'm going to ask. Like, are these the personal data you are actually processing, or is there more personal data? Your retention period, I think, is one of the things I usually ask. So once you capture that data, what do you do with it? Who processes it? Then your retention period, what happens when, after you're done with the data, what do you do? How long do you keep it for? Then I go on to breaches. Have you had any breaches? And star request, because with this, well, this is my first audit. So with this particular audit, I just kept asking every single person about because there's no process in terms of how they handle star requests. They have a procedure, but no one knows about it. So it's like, have you gotten one before? Do you know the process of who do you send it to when you get it? And I'm like, oh, I just send it to my line manager. Line manager, who do you send it to? We send it to IT. Then, so I'm going to interview IT to then find out how they do it. But I think for me, I'm just still trying to find my way to get like a very structured way, because my questions are very direct as opposed to being conversational.
Yes, that's why I think you'll be better than me, because I'm a bit conversational about things, aren't I?
Yes. So because that's my process for now. But obviously I'm still. So, what's your process?
Go on, I'll let you carry on.
Go on, Jan. No,
Jan. Question. Obviously, Phil, you've been auditing for years, so things that you do while you're auditing are second nature to you. But Esther, I'd like to get your perspective as someone who's new to auditing and your mm-hmm. opinions on it and how you tackle it. Obviously, you've explained the process, but for me who's not done a full compliance audit, or for people listening in, it seems like it can be really daunting, especially when I've seen them 35 page reports.
Yeah, okay. So first of all, while I was shadowing Phil, like trying to get his, so for someone like me, I try to always
keep talking. I'm just flashing up this ICO handbook so people can see what it is we're talking about, and then just carry on talking. I'm just going to scroll through bits of it, so we'll send it out afterwards. I can't find it online.
Okay, so for me, when I was shadowing Phil, I tried to mimic other people's way of doing things, because he's been doing it for years. I'm new into it, so I don't have a set system in my head on how to do it. And when it came down to interviewing, I knew immediately I was going to adopt Phil's system, because Phil is very conversational. Like, they just keep talking, trying to understand, have a feel of how they process data, how they handle data, things like that. Whereas for me, and based on my background, my legal background, I'm very direct with questions. I don't like when people speak in between. It's noise to me, and I might end up become selective when it comes to listening. So I'm very direct. What personal data do you have? Like almost as if I'm in court, yes or no. That's my way. Like, just tell me. And I do appreciate the conversational part, because it would bring out other elements that I'm not actually thinking about. So I'm trying to merge those two ways, the directional ways and the conventional and conversational ways together to try to like find a balance. It's difficult now because I'm still very direct. Like, I can ask, how long do you hold personal data for? If they go, I'll just go back and go, roughly how long? So we get the conversation moving and I get to where I am. And then once all my questions have been answered, then I can go conversational saying, oh, can you talk me through this process? Or what would you do in this situation? So that's how I'm approaching it for now. I'm not sure if it works well, but that's my approach.
I don't think it matters on the approach, as long as you get to the right answer, the finishing line. This handbook is really good material. It's well out of date because it's 98 Act, but it just gives you a lot of pointers and things worth kind of flicking through. I tend to, so the first thing I want is a lot of information up front. I want the ROPAs, which I think are an absolute critical cog. I want to see if there's a data protection compliance and management policy, something that is overarching everything. I want to look at privacy notices, and that's probably enough. And then on site, I want to have a look at more. So with every topical area, whether it's privacy notices, ROPAs, processes, DPAs, minimization, accuracy, retention. I'm looking at, is there a policy? Has the organization got a stance on this? And the stance might be, we're going to comply with the law, or it might be, we're going to go above the law, or it might be, something else. It might be it's a complicated international organization and they've got a complicated policy arrangement. So the first thing I'm looking for is there a policy that helps guide people's decision making in this topical area? Then I'm looking for, is there a procedure? Is there a how to do something, how to manage a rover, how to select a processor, how to appoint a processor, how to do a DPIA, how to write a privacy notice, all that type of stuff. And I won't just accept, good, there is one, tick. I'm like, is it any good? Does it say? Is it comprehensive? Does it cover everything? A data protection compliance management policy should cover every single aspect of data protection, children's data, everything should be in this policy. Even if you don't have children's data, have a policy on it. We don't set out to collect children's data, etc. So I'm looking at, have I got those two? And then are they any good? And I'm looking in like a ROPA, for instance, or a privacy notice. I'm looking at the structure of things. Like, does it comply with Article 13? Has it got everything in there that Article 13 requires, or Article 30 requires, or Article 28 requires? So in a ROPA, I'm looking across, usually they're in Excel, aren't they? I'm looking across the columns. And if they're in multiple sheets or multiple workbooks, the first thing I do is get them all and stick them in one place. So I can look at the relative structures of each of the different sheets. I can look at the relative information, the rows. I can filter out all the things using special category data. You can't do that when things are scattered over multiple documents. So the first thing I do is I keep a preserver copy of the original and I create my own working copy, basically, and then I can really get into it.
Can you all see how hard it is to follow Phil when it comes to
that's why we record
it's so he's so in depth like with it.
I'm looking at structure. So I'm looking at on a rope and look at the columns. Has he got the right columns in it? And I'm looking for, not just what the law requires, I'm looking for good practice. Is there a specific ID reference number for each row? So if I resort the spreadsheet, I'm going to lose all those. Oh, I've got a question.
It's from Lawrence. He's raised his hand. I don't know if you want to unmute or if this is the question that you want to ask.
Yeah, that's just the question. When you mentioned you look at their privacy notices, like in a local authority, are you looking at a minimum, or if they have too many, or just the quality of a sample of the privacy notices? That's what I would want to get a sense of when you're doing an audit.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question, because sampling is a key point, isn't it? Particularly something like retention. Are we looking at a sample, a representative sample of all the records to determine if the retention schedule is adhered to? And in privacy notices, there shouldn't be too many for me to be able to review all of them, look at all of them and work out, who's the audience, what's the structure, does it cover what it should cover? I would in privacy notices, ROPAs is different, but by getting all the ROPAs, I'm going to come to the question about OneTrust in a minute, but getting all the ROPAs into one place enables me to do a better analysis. I can filter the information to look at departments or types of data subject or different categories of data or different international transfers without putting it all in one place. I can't do that for a ROPA, but privacy notes, I would try and look at them all, depending on how many you've got. But I can't imagine there'd be more than like 30 privacy notices. It just takes time. That's the problem.
Yeah, I'd add that as a recommendation if there are too many as well. So,
and Stella's point is really close to my heart, because I hate ROPAs on Excel. Excel is not the place to keep ROPAs, really. Aye. There's no verge control. Well, no verge control. There's no data validation, usually. There's no rigid structure. People can add columns on. They can put invalid entries in. A database is a much better place, but you don't get the same view with a OneTrust or other database system as you do with Excel. I would try and output all the documents into an Excel format for analysis, but I get the point. It's different if you've got a big database and you're having to go through it record by record by record by record. And in OneTrust case, those records are spread out over multiple screens and you got to click through next, next, next. It makes the job a lot harder to do an audit, I think.
Quickly come back on that. With a ROPA, would you expect for each line in the ROPA a relevant privacy notice, or would a relevant privacy notice be two or three of the lines in a ROPA? See a relationship there?
Absolutely. I was going to come to that, because one of the next things I do is I look at the ROPA and I'll try and triangulate. I'm trying to triangulate what the ROPA says happens, what the privacy notice says happens, what actually happens in the business. If I can triangulate those things, then I'm onto a bit of a winner. But I don't expect a privacy notice for each row on the ROPA, it could be that the whole of HR, might be 10 or 15 mm-hmm. rows, is actually in one privacy notice. And I don't often see a kind of a reference on the ROPA to which privacy notice that particular row relates to, which again, I think would be quite a good thing to do. Then you've got some kind of ability to triangulate those three aspects. What's going on in the privacy notice, what's going on in the ROPA, and what's going on actually in reality on the ground. But for you, Imran, I mean, absolutely use Excel. It is a great tool. It is fantastic. It's flexible. It's usually free, but it comes with costs, which are, you know, making it properly multi-user, making it version controlled, much harder. But, you know, there are options to OneTrust, but ultimately a system, I think a database system is better, but there's nothing wrong with using Excel. And in fact, it's a good starting point, a good tool. So I'm once I've looked at the structure of a ROPA, I'm then looking at the, sounds like a ROPA session, this, doesn't it, rather than an audit session. I'm looking at the, is it comprehensive enough? And this, when I'm coming back to privacy notice, you know, I'm looking at it, I'm thinking, there's nothing in there about HR, nothing in there about IT, nothing about finance, nothing in there about company secretarial. You know, do they process for these purposes? If so, where are they in the ROPA? Nothing there about health and safety. So I'm looking at, am I trying to get a feel for, is it comprehensive enough? And the same with the privacy notice, you know, structurally, is it right? And does it describe the type of processing I would expect as a data subject? So what's the scope of it, and how comprehensive is it? And then I'm looking at the content. You know, is the stuff in that ROPA, is it any good? You know, does it say indefinite? Are there gaps in it, you know, for retention? Does it say, yes, we use Facebook and Hotjar and all sorts of weird and wonderful marketing tools and no international transfers? I'm trying to find out if it makes sense.
So with this, what level of depth would you go into? Would it depend how many days you've got to do it? So, or no, would you use a sample of three per department?
Do it regardless.
I would bang through it. I mean, I would bang through it. But again, if I can get it all into one Excel sheet, I can pinpoint the bits I know are going to be pain points. I can find, if I get it all in one sheet, it might be 2,000 rows. I can search for all the rows with special category data in. I can then have a look at those. I can search for all the rows with Facebook in, or, you know, transfers to the US or whatever.
So you look for where the risks are most likely to be, and that's what you focus on.
To start with, yeah. If I'm short on time, I know. So I'm not going out to try and prove people are not compliant. What I'm trying to do is find out how compliant they are. Yeah, and if the ROPA's, you know, let's say it's a perfect ROPA, but there's no, I'm then looking at, well, is it reviewed periodically? Is it controlled? Is there some kind of version control on it? Does somebody own it? And then, you know, how well implemented is it? In other areas, you know, you've got a policy. Is it embedded? Do people know about it? Are they trained in it? Is there evidence of all those things? So I have been writing on, aren't I? I'm going to stop now. But that's how I would approach the audit. A policy procedure, and then I'm looking for evidence of that being implemented. I'm looking for evidence of management control structure around it. And I'm looking for evidence of implementation.
Stella's asked in the chat, how often would you review what is considered acceptable?
Well, I think this is a fast moving area, data protection. It's changed a lot since GDPR came into effect. We've got Brexit, that required change. We've had TREMS, we've had data protection framework. We've had all sorts of things that have thrown. So I think anything less than an annual review is, I don't think that's enough, really. I would like to see an annual review, or, you know, significant changes. You know, we get the data protection framework in place. What we're going to do when, in terms of renewing our privacy notices, are we going to wait until 3 years' time, or are we going to get on and change them now? So for me, it will be annual or on any significant change.
It's a useful exercise as well, just to understand where you're at, rather than, you know, evidence and the fact that you're compliant, to tune in on those gaps and focus on them as well. So there are different benefits for audits. It's not just, you know, if you think that you're in a good place, you can mark your own homework through an audit, or you can use it to mitigate the risks that you've got.
That's the problem. And one of the things that winds me up the most is when something says last review, you know, October 23, next review, October 26, and it's still got errors in it. You know, it's still referring to section 45 of the data protection. I'm thinking, well, what's the criticality of that review? What are they reviewing it for? You know, are they just ticky boxy, or actually are they actually reading it and interrogating it and testing it? I'm on a soapbox. Sampling's an interesting one. Esther, talk about sampling. I'm going to shut up for a minute.
Go on, Esther.
What's the question, sorry?
Well, sampling, you know, you can't look at everything. You've got to select the thing to look at.
Yeah, I think when it comes to sampling, I think it's more subjective because for me, Roper, for instance, if I'm looking at it, I look at gaps, like if it's a spreadsheet and then they, you know, they've completed the rows, but there's some missing bits in it, then I'm looking at it. Why is it missing? What is there? So that's how I pick what I need to look at. Obviously, people might have their own different. So the one I'm looking at now, every single blank area has been colored yellow. So I'm looking at every single white, what's missing, what should be there. Then I can build up my questions based on that. So if one doesn't have a retention period, then I'm going to ask, why is there no retention period? Are you holding it indefinitely? Or if one doesn't have special categories of data highlighted, I would ask, are you processing any? Do you even know what special categories of data are? Then I can go from there. So that's how I select. And then obviously anything that has special categories of that, I'm looking at it. I would look at it immediately. HR is one of the main ones that I like to look at because they hold, I think a lot of what I've seen in my experience with data protection is that a lot of organizations are not thinking internally. They're more thinking about customer data as opposed to employees' data. It's like they don't class it as personal part of GDPR. So HR is one of the places I like to look at why are you collecting this data? Because if you look at the list of personal data that during recruitment that people collect normally, and you find something like criminal conviction in their employee privacy policy, they might not actually collect that data. So why is it there? Do you intend to collect it? Because I know people write policies for the future, but for me personally, I like it where it's immediate. What are you doing now? Like, don't put personal data in that you do not collect, hoping you would collect it. It doesn't, because you might not have the security measures to protect it. So why is it there?
Yeah, so that's often a hangover from when they things were compiled in the first place, you know, because everyone started off with a fairly broad net and maybe haven't narrowed it down.
So that's how I pick.
We've got a question in the chat. So when looking at gaps, do you think do you get a feeling if the organisation is systemically at an issue? I.e. lots of blank spaces creates an issue. Suddenly a Taylor Swift song comes to mind.
you're looking for systemic issues, you know, seeing if there's an organisational, you know, problem, you know. And I think what you highlighted, Esther, is in, and I've worked a place where it's been very hard to kind of get things embedded, you know, get things approved and then rolled out. And you know, if that is how it is in the particular organization, then that's a systemic issue, isn't it? No policy procedures have been rolled out, and that's an organizational failing. You know, DPA might be trying as hard as it can to get it signed off by senior management, or you know, implemented through training department, but you know,
that can be the benefit of an audit, though, you know, to give the DPO more backing when going to board and saying, look, these are the issues. It's been, whether it's by an internal or external auditor, this is what needs to be focused on. These are the risks.
So what challenges, Esther? Sorry, go on, Jasmine.
No, I was just going to ask what common non-compliances you find. Are there patterns through various organisations, or is it very
retention?
I think
retention.
Yeah, I think the key is also what are we rating? Are we rating? Are we looking for non-compliances? Are we saying is it compliant, non-compliant? Is it Boolean like that? Or are we saying it's almost compliant, you know, just about compliant, completely compliant, not compliant at all? Are we are we trying to get a feeling of assurance? Is it going to stay compliant? So you take something like SARS, you know, have you had any subject action requests? You what? Right, okay. Or have you had any subject action requests? No, we've not had any subject action requests. Right, okay. Have you got a policy? Yeah. Have you got a procedure? Yeah. Have you got a register? Yeah. Have you got any? It's empty. She never had one. No. Right, okay. Are you compliant or you're not compliant? You know, strictly speaking, you're compliant, but, you know.
I think what
confidence have you got? They're going to stay compliant.
Yeah. That's a good point.
I think in terms of rating, like how we rate them, because that is a bit subjective, or almost entirely subjective, because with this organization, for instance, I know they do have really good policies in place. And what they're lacking is the implementation and the awareness of those policies. And I've been thinking from day one, how will I rate you? Because I know you do have, you just don't, is it going to be like on a scale of 1 to 3, for instance? Am I going to give you 2 because you do have the necessary documents and policies in place?
Soft. You are getting soft. Where's that barrister gone? Hey?
I know, but and at the same time, I'm like, well, you're not compliant. So I should give you a 0 or -0 if it's possible. But you also have to understand, I think sometimes I just put myself in their shoes that if they know, they will do more. So it's knowing enough for you to say they're not compliant, because once they know where to find it and it's been distributed, a lot of things can be fixed. But at the same time, I also have to think about, if it's been distributed, are they going to be compliant? Are they going to adhere to the policies? Probably not. So it's an assumption.
If an organization does have everything in place on paper, but for example has never received a subject access request, what would you do? How would you rate that?
I wouldn't rate them as non-compliant because they haven't received it. So my question would be, so when I was doing the interview, what I was asking is, if you have a SAR request, how would you manage it? Just to pick their brain on how they would do it. So if they say, oh, we're going to send it to my line manager, your line manager, how would you do it? Oh, we're going to send it to IT. IT, are you going to do it? So if someone can just tell me a bit of how they can enforce and they know the timeline, I would rate them as probably like a 2. Not a 3, but like a 2. But that's why I think it's subjective. It's not, I mean, because you don't want to make them feel...
Yeah, it's tricky. Oh, you're getting soft again. The tricky thing is that what does the law require? It requires you to respond to subject access requests and other types of requests within a calendar month. And, you know, that if you're responding, you've got to provide all that metadata plus a copy of information. And you've got to make sure you don't, you know, provide any third party data that you shouldn't, unless it's reasonable. And you applied exemptions correctly. So in the absence of having any subject access requests to have a look at, then... You know, I found myself in a situation where I thought, well, they're definitely not non-compliant because there's no evidence of non-compliance.
Yeah.
And they're not actually compliant because there's no evidence of compliance.
Yeah.
But, you know, what assurance have I got that if they've got a SAR, they're going to handle it properly? So we ended up introducing a new feature to the audit reports where, you know, we gave a compliance rating and then we gave an assurance rating. Mm-hmm. And the kind of compliance was kind of like, you know, a relatively high level of assurance. But of compliance, but a very low level of assurance that they actually knew what they were doing. It's a tricky one. So you only picked up the rating because you were saying about, is it non-compliant or is it compliant, Jasmine? And what we're finding in practice is that, you know, it's not one or the other. It's usually on every single thing you look at, it's kind of, you know.
Yeah.
So you might say, yes, you've got good policies, but they're not embedded. So do you rate policies high?
Say if you've got a checklist for what would constitute red, amber, yellow, green, that's 4. So out of four, it's got 3. So surely you would give it yellow in that instance, or would you have it as a separate grey because it's not been tested?
Well, grey is unknown or untested or not applicable.
Yeah. All right. Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, if there's no electronic marketing going on, you're looking at the PECA. If there's no unsolicited electronic marketing, then it's a not applicable. You know, that's what you've been told, and you can't find any evidence to the contrary. Reporting back is important, and action planning as well. So we're running out of time rapidly here, but I wanted to ask you what the biggest challenges were, Esther, as well. So I know my biggest challenge, I think, on doing these.
I think mine would be speaking to the right person, because the people I've been speaking to with this audit, I don't think that they're the right people. Like, they don't have the knowledge of the department. So they're always referring to other people. Oh, someone might be able to answer you more. I'm like, so I should be speaking to the relevant people who can give me a better picture of what is happening within the organization. And personally, and that's in terms of the audit. But personally for me is... trying to balance being really direct and being soft, like you said, because I still have to think about the fact that they are trying, and the size of the organization does matter when it comes to GDPR, because there are some organizations that don't need to have certain things in place. So if I'm being really strict and saying, oh, this is the law, am I being too strict on them because they don't need to have certain things in place? So
yeah, the worst thing that can happen, I think, is that you get the wrong person and you duff them up, and then the shutters go up and you don't get anything. You just cannot get the right information out. So that's why I'm a bit more chatty about it, because I got to get people on side. They've got to trust me. They've got to trust I'm not going to throw them under a bus organizationally. So yeah, that's why I'm a bit of a softy when it comes to the auditing.
No, with the interviews, I'm not soft with the interviews. Probably with the like rating, I might be like, okay. But with the interviews, I am very direct. I don't want any. I don't want too much conversation. I just want you to tell me what's going on in there. Now I think I'm going to start implementing that conversational style just to get people.
It's a balance.
You got to balance it.
I'm too far one way. You need to.
Yeah.
Lauren's asking what we mean by assurance. I mean, for me, that's kind of like trying to determine, you know, is that compliance position going to stay the same or improve? So I'm looking for some kind of level of, you know, there are processes, there are procedures, they are well established, they're mature, they're going to stay in place, you know, and without that, I can't get a sense of assurance. So it's a bit of competencies, a bit of cultures, a bit of a lot of things. But again, it's quite subjective. You know, it's, you know, there's breach reporting procedures. People don't know about it. You know, there's no methodology for updating changes or reviewing things or for training or for awareness raising over time. Therefore, my level of assurance drops every time one of those boxes doesn't get ticked effectively. My biggest problem there, I think, we've run out of time, but is I've got to, just throw it out there, then we'll probably have to finish. Trying to get a feel for compliance with Article 32 and Principle 6, so security. Because in the GDPR, it's so
loose.
Woolly in a way, loose. So, you know, take a risk-based approach. So you would start off, you know, we're not trying to set out to do a security audit. So you would set out by saying, have you got a risk-based approach for looking at data protection risk in the business? And most people look like blankly out there, as you two are doing. What you're talking about, Phil, you know,
but I
think is the hardest area. You know, what is appropriate for one set of data is not appropriate for another set of data. It's very, very tricky to test that and then to feed back on it as well.
There's so much involved within that concept as well. Data security could have its own audit. You know, there's different types of security that you need to consider, whether it's organizational, which will be looked at, physical or technical. And then, as you say, in, you know, the levels of security required for different types of data. So
yeah,
I suppose the ROPA gives some indication. But
how about multinational organizations where, like when I sent you the binding corporate rules, those kind of organizations, I think that is where I personally need to learn, because when they are sharing data and then they are scattered all over the world, it's like, how do we get an overview? Because not everybody within the organization would understand, because it will keep pushing. Oh, this one can tell you more about this company. This one can tell you more about this.
But that was a very interesting scenario. I know we're now over time, but interesting scenario. Client says, we've got binding corporate rules. Oh, have you? Right. Okay. Well, let's go and look on the European Data Protection Board's website, where there's a list of approved binding corporate rules, and see if you're there. Oh, you're not there. No, these aren't binding corporate rules at all, because they haven't been adopted. Therefore, they're not valid. But without doing that digging, you're just going to, you cannot accept what, when I was trained auditing in the 90s, right? They said it's as simple as ABC, accept nothing, believe nobody and challenge everything.
Yeah, I think I still follow that one.
Definitely. I will be following that one. Yeah.
Right, so I think we're out of time, but thank you both of you for your insights. It's been invaluable, and thank you everyone for listening in. We'll be back next week with a GDPR radio session, and in the meantime, have a great weekend and rest of next week. So yeah, we'll see you next week.
We'll send out that audit handbook. If you want it, contact Miles, and Miles will push it out if that's okay. I can't find it online, otherwise I'll put a link in there.
Thanks everyone.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Bye.